I don't know, smattering of research results over that have, you know, that have used the concepts that you guys talked about in class and have appeared over the last year or so. This was an hour and a half originally, so I might speed through some of these things. Who's seen this before?
They did it for their homework.
You did it, right? So this is the first swing thing Juan and I ever did, and by Juan and I mean him, in terms of supervised learning. Right? It was literally, this is the Ising model. You know, this is the, as you know, the two outputs of your feedforward neural network. And here's the classification of images at various temperatures, you know, across the phase boundary as a function of system size. Do I have the collapse? No, I don't. From this, you can get the, you know, we observe, you can get the correlation length exponent by collapsing these curves. Well, one thing this illustrates is generalization. You know, because generalization is the idea that you can generalize your results to test cases that haven't been observed in the training set. And so the training set that Juan and I presume you guys looked at was a fixed number of temperatures above and below TC. Whereas this plot on the test set is a whole range of temperatures. And you see that, you know, it successfully classifies and successfully basically, I would say, interpolates near the phase transition. So I think it's a good example of generalization. Transfer learning. Transfer learning is the concept that you train a neural network and use either the trained weights or the partially trained weights to test on other systems. Okay, like completely different. So did you guys do triangular labs? No. Okay, so you can imagine taking your code for the Heisenberg model, the Ising model on a square lattice that has a critical point 2.269, the one you guys looked at. You can train that on ferromagnetic and paramagnetic configurations, and then generate a test set from a different lattice. Okay, so use the trained weights and biases to classify something that you haven't seen before. So these are results from the triangular lattice, a test set produced on the triangular lattice. And we know from StatMech that the critical point there is actually at a different temperature. Okay, phase transitions, or the position of critical points, aren't universal. So in this case, T over J is at 3.6. And you know, if you take that network, produce this test set, ask it to classify, this is what comes out, and you'll see that you get the correct phase boundary for the triangular lattice case. So in some sense, that's an example of what people call transfer learning. Lots of times, transfer learning in industry is only the weights are only partially trained. So you partially train them and then train some other set of weights. These are the full set of weights trained. So these are still ferromagnetic phases down here. But in principle, you could, you know, this idea that you're detecting a magnetization can be generalized to the idea that you're detecting some other order parameter at a different ordering wave vector, right? That was Q equals zero. You could look at Q equals pi, or Q equals, I don't know, it's probably pi by two or something like that. And in principle, you'll get the same results, although you do have to be careful about how you basically strip out, you know, the two-dimensional configurations in our case to a one-dimensional vector. So you have to somehow retain the form factor, as we call it, between the different lattices and things like transfer learning. But so machine learning can demonstrably detect, I'd say, conventional order parameters. But it's also good at detecting unconventional phases. So you guys looked at the Z2 gauge theory, right? So this is actually a similar model that has a few different features. So this is called square ice, or sometimes it's called a Coulomb phase. So this is a model that has a Hamiltonian that's the sum over all vertices of charges on the vertex squared. Okay, and a charge is just the sum of all I in the vertex as zi. Okay, so what it wants is the sum of up and downs to be as small as possible, so zero. Okay, so like plus one, minus one, minus one for SZ. And so this is an eight vertex model. It's like the gauge theory in the sense that there's no constraints on the ground state except for these eight constraints. So you take a vertex, you randomly assign it one of these, you go to the next vertex, you assign it one of these again, consistently, because they share bonds, right? And so on. When you do that, you get an extensive ground state degeneracy. It can be calculated exactly. So that means that there's an extensive manifold of states that all are zero energy, okay? Like, you can just draw one out. As the system size scales, the number that you can draw out, scale proportional to n, so it's extensive. This phase, called the Coulomb phase, has an algebraic decay of correlations. Okay, so if I look at the correlation function between a spin at site zero and a spin at site r, okay, separated by a distance r, I guess I can call this r, then the correlations decay is 1 over r squared. So it's fundamentally different than the high temperature phase of the Ising model, where the correlations decay is exponentially, okay? So you can train the neural network just like you guys did on two temperatures, zero, which is this algebraic decay, and infinite, which is just random. This one is, if I look close enough, I can tell. So this one here is random, okay? And this one here is square ice. So similar to what you saw with the gauge theory. But unlike the gauge theory, a feed-forward neural network will distinguish these two. So that's what you tried, right? You tried to distinguish these with in the gauge theory. I'll show the gauge theory next. I just have these out of order. So if you use 100 hidden neurons and you just test on these two or train on these two different cases, this works, and it works with very high accuracy. And what I always like to remind everybody is that when I'm looking at images like this and trying to distinguish by eye, I'm actually giving myself more information than the feed-forward neural network has, because I'm telling you here which sites are adjacent. Whereas in the feed-forward neural network, you just feed it in as a one-dimensional vector. Okay, so that works. This is the case you looked at, the Z2 gauge theory or the classical toric code. Oh, there's eight. So the other one was a six vertex model. This is an eight plaquette model, sorry. So this is different because, you know, you have a product of sigma z's, plus or minus ones now. And so you allow these fully polarized or fully empty sites, as you know. Physically, okay, again, you have a ground state degeneracy, but you also have an exponential decay of the two-point function, okay? So the correlations decay exponentially, just like they do, not exactly quantitatively, but qualitatively, like they do in the infinite temperature phase. So in some sense, okay, so here's the two configurations. I got them on here. So in some sense, this is the reason we believe why the feed-forward neural network has trouble distinguishing between the infinite temperature state and the eight vertex, or the ground state of the Z2 gauge theory. It's really simply guessing with 100 neurons. So you can see right away that, you know, looking at these images to your eye look fairly similar, but the simple feed-forward neural networks definitely classify things differently, you know, depending on, I would guess, somehow the decay of two-point correlation functions. So actually, when I was in Everett's talk, and he was talking about these recurrent neural networks, he was talking about time series data, remember? But in principle, there's no reason that the time series data that you put into a recurrent neural network has to be time series, you know, T1, T2, T3, T4. So it could actually, in principle, be, you know, it could be this series of data. It could be the R vector between, say, zero and some arbitrary spin value. So it'd be interesting to look at recurrent neural networks, and in replacing the time series data, I think, with the position series data, to see if it could distinguish between, you know, exponential in this case and algebraic in the case of square ice. So that'd be a fun project to try. And again, what Juan did was the convolution network. Do you guys do this? Convolution neural network? Right. So the big point about the convolution network is that, you know, it restores the concept of what's local, you know, in two dimensions by using the convolution filters. So CNNs really are what's like the, when you talk about deep learning and how the field changed in 2012 with ImageNet and everything, it's really CNNs that made the big difference. I'd say over the last 5 or 6 years. If you look at your Z2 gauge theory, there's no finite temperature critical point, but there is a finite temperature crossover. And that's because of the finite size of the system. So when I have a torus and I have the Z2 gauge theory on there, what distinguishes the ground states is four different topological sectors. Did you guys talk about that? Topological sectors in the Z2 gauge theory? So the topological sectors are basically what's being preserved by local gauge flips or local gauge moves. They're gauge invariant. But at some temperature, which I can determine based on the fact that I just want to basically traverse the torus in either direction with errors, so if it's L by L torus, I want the probability of traversing the torus with thermal errors, so this is just a Boltzmann probability, to be approximately 1, which gives me an idea for a crossover, T star, which is inverse of the logarithm of the system size. And so you can see that in the output layer of the neural network. If you train it on finite temperature, you know, you put in a Boltzmann temperature into the gauge theory. And so this is the two neurons again, you know, low temperature, high temperature, as a function of beta. And you can see that the 50% confidence level changes as a function of system size. And you can convince yourself that you can see a logarithmic crossover there. So again, this is something that is useful for your topological quantum computing. So in topological quantum computing, this is the basic model of the topological qubit that people are trying to design, say, at Google and IBM and places like that. What this is showing you is that feed-forward neural networks can detect the difference between, you know, the what I would call the topological or the error-correcting regime and the you know, the thermally decohered regime of the topological qubit. So you can right away see that this stuff could be useful for future design of topological machines. I forgot I had a muskrat in here. Okay, so besides stuff you've seen, what are people using supervised machine learning for? So again, remember, supervised means labels, right? So yeah, that's what I was illustrating, labels here. Okay, well, Matt Beach and Anna Golubeva here have a paper both on the archive and in the blog that we're working on that looks at classification of vortices. Okay, so you've just classified either local order parameters or local global order parameters like the magnetization or local constraints in your Hamiltonian. You can ask more sophisticated questions like whether or not a feed-forward neural network is able to classify something like a vortex, anti-vortex unbinding transition, which occurs in Koslitz Salus. Okay? So I won't tell you this because you can read it on our blog, but basically you can easily get a feed-forward neural network to find the Koslitz Salus transition, even though there's not an order parameter per se. But then the question is one of interpretation. I think in physics we're always interested in why we learn something, you know? And it's a very interesting kind of test case if you look at the XY model and try to classify the Koslitz Salus transition. Because what you find, I believe, is that you essentially classify the high temperature and low temperature phases on finite size magnetization, almost like a finite size crossover in this case. It's basically the same thing. And it's very difficult to convince yourself that you're actually learning vortex, anti-vortex, and binding. Incidentally, this idea of using a recurrent neural network would be interesting here, because in the XY model, you have a Koslitz Salus transition that separates a high temperature phase that has exponential decay of correlations to an entire phase of algebraic decay. You know, the entire phase of the XY model below the critical temperature is algebraic. So in principle, I think a recurrent neural network should be able to classify the difference between those two cases. This is something I did with Jeff Chen, who's a professor in the Department of Physics at the university, and he works on polymer physics. So he's a Monte Carlo expert who studies how, you know, long chains of monomers fold, right? So the protein folding problem is like one of these holy grails of soft condensed matter. People are always trying to understand, why proteins in the body fold a certain way. But when you simulate a string of monomers with realistic interactions, you know, lots of times you get stuck in local minima and so on. One challenge of this field is identifying different structures once the protein is folded. Okay, so here's pictures of different structures. What is this one? Coil, globular, which has no structure, but like, you know, so one is sort of like extended, one collapses. One collapses into a particular crystal structure, which is pretty hard to see, and then one gets like a more extensive crystal structure. So they call McKay and anti-McKay. So there's all these, I guess, three or four different phases, which you can adjust a parameter in a simulation, and you can cross phase boundaries. And what Jeff Chen and his students showed is that you can detect these phase transitions, you know, as the output of, again, feed-forward neural networks. In this case, he tried two things. He tried inputting the occupation. So he had a three-dimensional box, and he just discretized it with a bunch of zeros, and everywhere there was a monomer, he put one, you know, one, 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 one. And he sent that, all those ones and zeros, as a three-dimensional box into a feed-forward neural network and asked it to classify. It never worked, and I don't know why. Then what he did is he went back and fed in the XYZ positions of the monomers, or all the monomers in the polymer, and then it worked. So you call that different features, right? The feature vector is different. You know, the feature vector could be positions, could be occupations, something like that. I think what this demonstrates is the fact that, you know, different feature vectors can give you much different learning behavior. And so it's something to keep in mind in physics. If you're looking at something like this, you can imagine either inputting the raw spins as angles, or you can imagine going through this and processing where all the vortex positions are and feeding that into a feed-forward neural network. Those will behave differently. So that's giving different feature vectors to your feed-forward neural network. This is another interesting application of, again, it's sending different feature vectors to a feed-forward neural network. So you might call this what, feature processing or feature. What do you call it when you take your data set and you like massage it so that it works better? That's basically what this is. So detecting topological phases, as you learned with the Z2 gauge theory, is notoriously difficult. So what people have done, Frank Zhang and Una Kim and Cornell in particular, have discovered a set of feature vectors that, so when you take a raw spin configuration from some sort of, there's like a generalized toric code with transverse and longitudinal magnetic fields. Okay, so that gives you a topological phase, but it has a two-dimensional phase diagram. So basically what they showed is that there's a certain set of generalized feature vectors which are related to the Hall conductivity, so something Kataev discovered years ago, that if you process raw data in these types of models into that new feature vector and feed that into a feed-forward neural network, you can get very successful kind of generalized phase detection for these types of topological phases. So I think, again, I think this is fairly relevant both for topological ordered spin liquids, but also for things like topological quantum computing. So one thing you might have kind of figured out if you're processing data that comes from your classical Monte Carlo simulations of the Ising model or the gauge theory with a feed-forward neural network is that you've replaced an estimator when you've done that. Okay, I mean, you have labels, so you have to have a priori knowledge of something. But in this type of machine learning, what you're doing is you're generating configurations with a Markov chain. Okay, so this is like configuration x minus 2, you know, x minus 1. So each one of these is a feature vector or a vector of spins, xi, xi plus 1. What you're doing is feeding those vectors into a feed-forward neural network or a classifier or a Boltzmann machine or something. But you're not using a conventional estimator to classify. So that becomes important when you study quantum systems, because in quantum Monte Carlo, what happens is you have a feature vector that's not just ones and zeros, but it's a D plus one-dimensional path integral. It's like a Feynman path. But once you have that Feynman path, it's basically classical. You know, I mean, it is classical unless there's a Berry phase or something. And you can treat that as a feature vector and feed that into a feed-forward neural network for classification. What that gets by is, and in maybe not a completely rigorous way, is the fact that these configurations could have different phases or different sign structures for different configurations. And that often gives you problems in calculating these estimators. But a couple groups did this. So Simon Trebst and Peter Brocker from Cologne last year took a fairly complicated D plus one dimensional simulation of fermions, okay, and fed basically you perform a Hubbard-Chernovitz transformation. You guys probably learned this. And you take the auxiliary field configurations in D plus one and feed those into basically a convolution neural network to classify phases. And what they found in a Hamiltonian that looks like this, okay, so it's like a Hubbard model, C dagger C, you know, these are charges hopping, these are occupation numbers. So they basically found that they were able to classify the difference between metallic and charge density wave phases, plus other phases that occur in these models on various lattices using this scheme. So here's actual pictures of the auxiliary fields. And you can see by eye that, you know, when this color map's applied, they look different. But what does that mean quantitatively? This is what the output of the neural network tells you, is that there's a crossover. And I think this phase boundary is known from a Majorana basis, but I forget where it is. It's somewhere out here. So again, you can bypass estimators. You can just feed in these D plus one dimensional Hubbard-Chernovitz fields directly for classification. Kelvin and SN also did this at San Jose State University. And they had a similar Hubbard model, but it was a three-dimensional Hubbard model. So in three dimensions, you know, there's an actual a finite temperature phase transition for large U, and it's a Neel transition. Okay, so this is because of Merman-Wagner theorem, or lack of. And so what Kelvin and Essen did was take feature vectors, which are, again, the auxiliary fields. But these were this is a three-dimensional spatial quantum Monte Carlo. So it's 3 plus 1. So it's actually four-dimensional space-time. And they did a set of convolutions to do the same type of thing there. So this convolution, you know, structure that, or this convolution strategy that you learned can really be applied to higher dimensional systems, I guess is the point. And okay, so let's see. Okay, so the colors here are the finite temperature phase boundary as a function of U. So this must be the gray is the exact value. And all the colors are from different, machine learning or different CNN outputs. Some of them, yeah, so here, like the 4x4x4 system size, if it's trained on U equals 5, gives you a pretty good phase diagram for small U, or phase boundary for small U, but then it blows up. And same in the opposite case, when you train it up here at 16, U equals 16, it basically blows up. But if you train at the ends, you know, 5 and 16, here and here, then you get phase boundaries which are much more reasonable. So these are what I would call generalization errors. You know, you haven't given it a training set that is representative of all the configurations in the region of interest, right? So CNNs, higher dimensional CNNs, generalization errors. Everett showed this plot. But this is, you know, this much more modern kind of field of many-body localization. Again, there's no order parameter. So there, it's difficult. I mean, there's not even any concept of equilibrium thermodynamics or equilibrium thermal expectation values. So it's relatively hard to look at phase boundaries in MBL systems. And what people did here, you know, in Titus Newport's group, was train the entanglement spectrum to get this entanglement boundary or this phase transition between MBL and ETH, or thermalized states. So Everett already talked about that. So that's fairly, you know, that's less than a year old. People are looking at these fairly topical condensed matter problems. Oh, this is something Pedro did. Actually, there was another paper by Loda Paulette's group on the archive using kernel methods yesterday, which is basically directly related to this. So the reason I put this up is because, you know, not everything has to be neural networks, of course. In supervised learning, more, they call it classical, but more classical machine learning approaches are things like support vector machines. Support vector machines, you define a kernel, and then that kernel basically learns something like an order parameter. Okay, so read this if you got time, but basically the idea is that if you have a support vector machine with a certain kernel order, okay, then you can use it to learn, like literally learn what the order parameter is. In this case, the 2D Ising model is the magnetization squared, right? And this can be, this SVM kind of concept can be generalized to also gauge theories and things with local constraints and topological order and so on. So I think a lesson here is that, you know, there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of incentive to look at neural networks and especially deep networks and convolution networks because of their success in classifying very large data sets. Tishby today is going to talk about why deep learning works. You know, why, you know, basically why deep learning seems to generalize well despite having a lot of parameters. But one point that we made in this paper is that if you have fairly small system sizes, then these classical machine learning methods like support vector machines work very well. They're just typically not scalable. Like, so when you have huge images or if you have huge system sizes, you know, I don't think we can get past something like 40 by 40, maybe 60 by 60 in these SVM methods. But the second thing is that they're highly interpretable. So in a support vector machine, you can extract the kernel and interpret that as an order parameter. You can get the mathematical structure of the order parameter. So unlike a CNN or a feedforward neural network, where you have all these weights and you have no idea what they mean, in these cases, you can basically look at the kernel and figure out exactly the mathematical structure of the order parameter. Okay, that was enough supervised learning. There's different types of unsupervised learning. So unsupervised means there's no labels. You have a bunch of pictures of cats and dogs. And then the question is, what do you want to do? So one strategy is clustering or association. Clustering means take this data set, process it somehow. I think you guys have done this. And look at the processed data and see if it's clustered. And then look closer at the clusters and then maybe find out what makes them different, right? So you hope if you have a good unsupervised learning method and you fed a bunch of pictures like this, you would get, is it 4 and 4 images of cats? 4 images of cats and 4 images of dogs in 2 unique clusters. Did you look at T-SNE? Yeah, right? Did you see these results here? This is Juan's T-SNE for the 2D Ising model. High temperature phase and 2 low temperature blobs, right? You can see really tight blobs for the highly ordered states. And then this kind of diffusive blob. So as the system size increases here, if T-SNE still works, I think you'd see a pretty nice phase separation between higher and lower. And these points that lie on the separation boundary or whatever would be basically critical. Lai Wang used this is PCA, right? Yeah, that's what this is. So you guys also did principal component analysis. Did you look at this data?
Oh, yeah, we reproduced it.
What's that?
We reproduced
You did this? Okay. I don't have to show it. Did you did you look at the VAEs?
No.
Okay, so the VAEs are cool. So similar idea. Okay, you're looking for clusters, unsupervised clusters, right? A variational autoencoder is like, okay, think of it as a feed-forward neural network. There's an input, there's an encoding stage, and then there's like a bottleneck. These kind of multiple layers. So you're usually encoding something, you're squeezing it down to a bottleneck and then bringing it back out again. What's happening in the middle of that bottleneck is you're compressing, you know, as much relevant information as possible into sort of as few network parameters as possible. And by studying the latent space of variational autoencoders, you can also determine some sort of clustering patterns.
Oh, but this is supervised, or?
Well, the output in this case has to have labels, yeah. Okay. But in the middle, yeah, I would call this maybe semi-supervised. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be, the output of the VAE could also be, you're typically supervising, actually you're not supervising on labels, so the output of the VAE could be another configuration. So you put in a configuration here, and then you get one out of the top. That's one way to think about it. And then you compare the two configurations so that in the VAE, you're basically learning some sort of, again, some latent structure here. Once the thing's trained, you can feed in random data, just random ups and downs, and hopefully you're generating a configuration out of this side. So in that sense, the output doesn't have labels, so hence unsupervised. But in the latent space, I think this is interesting in the latent space. So visualize, in this case, you have two parameters, and if you plot them against each other, you can see clustering, okay? And in this, and you can even associate the parameters to the magnetization if you know it a priori in the latent space. So this is this is an autoencoder with one latent variable here. So these are, I think these are really kind of powerful. I think VAEs are, there's a paper on the archive yesterday that talked about quantum variational autoencoders and whether or not you could use some sort of quantum hardware to encode these types of networks. This man is in the building, Evert van Nieuwenberg. So he invented a sort of semi-supervised method for detecting phase boundaries called the confusion method. So the confusion method is done by trying to label. So here's the Ising model. Here's the temperature. This is 2.269, say. So in the confusion method, which he alluded to, but he's like, I'm not going to talk about it in his talk. Basically, you scan the parameter space using a classifier, but you don't know the labels. You're trying to confuse the network. Okay, so you basically train it with deliberately incorrect labeled data, okay? And again, read the paper, but you say train it on train it on ferromagnetic and paramagnetic labels down here, and then try to confuse the thing. Move it, so this is actually still ferromagnetic. What happens is at the phase transition, you get a peak in this output of this neural network. And this is semi-supervised because you don't a priori know the labels, but you're giving it false labels and trying to fool the thing, okay? So there's some point where the false labels produce an output. This is a smaller system size, this is a bigger system size. That converge to one, basically. And he argues that, pretty convincingly, that this is the position of the phase boundary. So check that out. I think that's a cool method too. But I want to talk for the last 20 minutes about, I guess, stuff you guys have already looked at quite a bit, and that's unsupervised generative modeling, okay? So again, there's different strategies of unsupervised learning. Everything I showed you is clustering, basically, or phase detection, or detection of phase boundaries, or something like that. In generative modeling, you're also taking unlabeled data, but you're taking the unlabeled data and you're generating new data. Okay, so this is this is actually a latent space picture, but it's a famous picture of a cat from Hinton's group. That's basically, what the neural network sees after being trained on a whole bunch of cat pictures. It's kind of grotesque, I love it. Okay, so this is the RBM. You guys know everything about the RBM, right? Parameters, weights and biases, the joint distribution, okay? So it's just a distribution parameterized by all the weights and biases and a Boltzmann distribution. Do you reproduce this data? Giacomo's data?
Yeah.
Some of it?
Yesterday.
Yeah. Yesterday you did this? This is awesome. So, yeah, so just to remind you what you did, the colors are expectation values from, again, the visible layer here, right? And the visible layer is sampled after the machine is trained. And, you know, what's the deal with the hidden layers? Well, the hidden layers give you more or less expressiveness in the machine. So I've mentioned generalization. This is a concept for machine learning. So is expressibility. I'm not even sure that's a word. But expressibility in this context is the question of whether or not you have enough parameters to encode, in our case, somehow the relevant physics, right? Okay, so in this case, the number of parameters is controlled by the number of hidden units, right? So when you have an energy, magnetization, specific heat, susceptibility, the exact values are in black here, right? And as you increase the number of hidden units, you converge towards the exact answer, right? So magnetization works really well. Any ideas why? You don't need, like, four hidden units basically gives you a good magnetization. I don't know why, so if you find out, tell me. Specific heat, again, it's the fluctuation of energy, and the susceptibility are a bit worse. So I would say because you're learning on, you know, you're not training on the energy. You're not, you know, that the energy isn't what you're feeding the network. You're feeding it raw spin configurations, and the magnetization's an average value of those, right? So I think because you're learning on essentially the order parameter, the order parameters produce really well, really efficiently. But energy and energy fluctuation based estimators don't seem to work as well. So that's important. It's important for quantum systems, especially, which I'm going to get to. One can probe the, what is this? Dependence of physical observables on the hyperparameter. Oh, yeah, so this is just the scaling. This is just saying the same thing with finite size scaling. Okay, so 1 over the number of hidden units. Here's different temperature values. Okay, so you can see how slow or fast you're converging to the right value, the correct physical value, as you go this way down the plot. So this is critical for an L equals 8 by 8 system. And so at very small numbers of hidden units, your critical system is not being expressed very well. Okay, you don't have enough parameters in the neural network. Whereas if you're on some strongly ordered side of the transition, of course, no problem, right? This is directly at the critical point for different system sizes. So you can also do finite size scaling on the hardest part. Again, it's like this part here, the hardest part to learn. You can do finite size scaling and see how you converge to the difference between these lines are basically the difference between the specific heat for each of these system sizes. So, you know, it shifts as a function of system size. So you can see some sort of slow convergence as you get the larger and larger system sizes. Okay, so we'll get back to the Boltzmann machine in terms of tomography and representing wave functions and so on. But just be aware that Boltzmann machines are used in many other contexts. So one of them is this so-called self-learning Monte Carlo method. So the self-learning Monte Carlo method is, I mean, there's different ways of doing it, but you're basically attaching an auxiliary probability distribution, which could be a Boltzmann machine, to a conventional Markov chain Monte Carlo. And so what happens is, kind of philosophically, as you move along the Markov chain, you're taking the configurations, you're calculating things with them, but you're also training a Boltzmann machine. As the weights, do I have a picture? Yeah, as the weights and biases of the Boltzmann machine get trained, they'll do things like associate strong, you know, say neighbors of spins or maybe clusters of spins with strong weights in the machine. Then you can use the machine to suggest updates. So for example, if there's a cluster of spins on the visible units that develop strong weights, then when you flip this hidden unit, you'll change the probability, say, of the conditional probability associated with flipping this cluster of spins. So you're associating them together. And this can be used to design sort of machine-learned cluster updates for Monte Carlo, okay? So what this plot is showing is an Ising model. This is the autocorrelation function. So this is the correlation between a magnetization or a spin at some time t and delta t, let's just say, where delta t goes from zero to some large thing. So I don't know, it should be one. Oh, it's a connected two-point function. So I guess it's the magnetization. So it starts at some value. And a more efficient simulation is less correlated. So it means that your next step in the Markov chain is independent, okay? That's what you strive for in Monte Carlo. You want to have completely independent samples, right? If not, actually what happens is your variance is affected. So local updates is just single spin flips. If you have single spin flips in this case, this is what your autocorrelation looks like. As you do 600 or 800, steps in your Markov chain, you still have this proportion of correlation between your starting configuration and this configuration. Wolf updates are basically cluster updates, okay? They're cluster updates that you design with these Fehrenberg-Swensen clusters and flip with either probability one or a half, depending on how you build them. They're called naive wolf, but they're actually pretty powerful. They combat critical slowing down at critical points, so they're actually necessary. Self-learning is this thing I'm talking about. You're attaching an ancillary probability distribution and then learning correlations and then having those correlations that you've learned suggest updates. And so look how much the autocorrelation improves. It's pretty crazy. Actually, it's almost unbelievable. Okay, so this is another variation on this. Okay, well, this is a lot of writing. Basically, the point is the same thing. It's that you have a Markov chain. This is a Bloch-Gibbs sample. But in the Bloch-Gibbs sample, you can use a Boltzmann machine to suggest an update. So the point is you can add a rejection step. Okay, so you might be worried. Because what if you've trained a Boltzmann machine, but that Boltzmann machine generates something that's crazy, right? Which can happen. Like if you just use a limited data set and you train a Boltzmann machine, your P of lambda, might not be perfect. And so what that means is when you generate or when you reconstruct with a Boltzmann machine, you'll every once in a while throw out a configuration that's just completely improbable for the original Q, what I called it, right? So what this paper showed is you can add a rejection step so that those completely crazy configurations are eliminated according to a correct probability. So basically the idea is that you can use these updates suggested by an RBM, but you can eliminate all the approximation associated with the fact that you haven't maybe learned exactly the right distribution. So that was a short way of saying everything on this slide. This is some of Giacomo's early work on decoding, which he didn't talk about. So what this thing is the Tor code, the thing you guys looked at. What he's done is he has a restricted Boltzmann machine, so visible, hidden, visible, but these two vis and connected in the usual way, okay? So visible, each visible to hidden, but no visible to visible. So again, I told you the question of whether or not topological qubits are in the error correcting regime or not is important. So if I take your Z2 gauge theory and I start to populate errors into it with some probability, 0 to 1, there's a point called the threshold where you can't recover the original topological sector anymore. Okay? So what people who do quantum computing do is they read out so-called a syndrome. So in a Z2 gauge theory, a syndrome is just kind of the endpoints of an error chain. That you flipped, but the error chain, as I hope you know, is invisible. So all you can see is basically defect plaquettes. Here's one defect plaquette. That might be something with like three. You know, and this one might be something with three. And everything else satisfies the gauge constraints, right? Two up, two down, four up, four down. So the goal of error correction is to find this error chain or to find some other error chain to basically flip back the syndrome and erase the errors. If you do it like this, you retain the topological order. But if you take that error chain and you flip it around like, flip it around like this, then you flip that topological sector, okay? And you don't want to do that, because when you flip that topological sector, what you've done is corrupted the information in the topological qubit. So what Giacomo did in this paper was feed in the syndromes to this layer, okay, all the x's, and then feed in the error chains associated with them into this layer, and then train this Bolton machine. So train all these weights and biases. Then once the thing's trained, he would just feed in, say, a set of syndromes like you would get from experiment, and it would output an error chain. And then you impose that error chain and flip the spins. So this is finite size scaling, and there's another method, minimal weight perfect matching, which is just like matching all errors, all syndromes as close as possible. So he compared his neural decoder to the minimal weight perfect matching, and basically the point where they cross is what's called the threshold. It's about 11%, so this does pretty well on limited system sizes. For any errors up here, you can't recover the topological qubit. But for errors down here, you can. Okay. So Dan Gottesman's an expert in this type of decoding. And actually, one of the big applications for neural networks recently has been this idea of decoding not just topological codes, but color codes and other things. Okay, you guys did this, right? So I'm going to skip this. Skip this. This is how you, this is an off diagonal. This is a diagonal. Oh, yeah. This is a diagonal estimator. Did you see this before? This is how you calculate an off diagonal estimator with an RBM. That's what's cool about this, right? You train an RBM in one basis, but then you can measure things in another basis. That's the magic of this local observable. Here's the entanglement entropy. Do you guys see this? Did you show you this? Yeah. I don't know what this is. Phases, right? Another, it looks like this, another structure. RBM with two visible layers, one for amplitude, one for phase. Now you can do tomography. You can go to Kevin Resch's lab, get optics data. You know, you have horizontal and vertical polarizers. You can train the phase. Oh yeah, deep learning. This is what Tishby's talking about today. When you guys do the Bolson machine, expressiveness of the machine is directly related to the number of parameters. That's what the number of hidden units is. But that's not why everyone's been interested in machine learning lately, since 2012. It's, you know, simples, you know, two-layer feed-forward neural networks, you can make that have as many parameters as possible. But what people discovered in 2012 was by using multiple layers, something changes. And what changes is essentially the generalization error, okay, so how well you classify unseen data. And basically, what Tishby's gonna talk about is the fact that when you have these very deep networks, generalization error does not increase with the number of parameters, as you would naively think. So what Tishby's gonna argue is that, you know, it's not just the number of parameters that matters in learning. And it's something to do with the stochastic gradient descent as you propagate through these networks that makes deep learning so powerful. That's basically his thesis. And it'll be something called the compression phase. So he'll talk to you guys about that. There's a lot of research in deep learning. You know, the hierarchical structure of data that you see in like faces is reflected in all these layers, hidden layer one, you know. Especially in convolutions, you'll pick out edges, you know, then you'll start picking out faces and or noses and then faces and so on. This doesn't necessarily apply to the data we look at. So we're still trying to understand if deep learning works for physics. Because, you know, you have faces here, but typically if we're just looking at a correlation function, and that's the long wavelength feature we're interested in, you know, there's no structure like this, okay? So as you go on and you use machine learning in physics, I think you have to think about what you know, what we're doing and whether or not we're just mirroring what's the advances that are happening in machine learning, whether or not we really understand the structure of the data and why neural networks work, you know what I mean? So the example is, if I take a Bolson machine and add another layer, not like this, so an actual second layer that I train, so two hidden units, so this is three visible units and six hidden units. Yeah. You can try to reproduce the data that you guys did with a structure like this. And this is the interesting one here. So flat means what you did, a two-layer restrictive Bolson machine, okay, with 16 hidden units. So this is exact here. And blue is 16 hidden units. Now add 10 more. When you add 10 more hidden units to another layer, you really increase the number of parameters. But what happens in the specific heat data is you basically don't improve the learning at all. You know, you maybe smooth it out a bit, but you don't increase the number of parameters in the same way that you would if you just made the second layer fatter. So I don't know why this happens. This is what you would call a training error or something. You have enough training data. You have enough parameters in your machine, but for some reason that second layer doesn't like to be trained. Okay, so you can't just take, you know, naive ideas from, I think, machine learning and necessarily get drastic improvements in physics problems. That's what this told me anyway. Oh, there's more evidence that this doesn't work. I just got to show this because Bodan wanted me to. So why else do we look at Bolson machines? So Bolson machines are great for tomography and all these things you guys have learned. You know, we can represent wave functions and so on. But Bolson machines can also be used for reinforcement learning and other tasks. So reinforcement learning is how you play Atari games and drive cars and stuff. So you typically have a state, cars on the road, and you have an action, turn the wheel. So the simplest is this 1D inverted pendulum. This is a classic control. People who do control engineering basically try to solve this. You invert a pendulum and the thing's unstable, right? And so you got to move. So there's only two actions, left or right. There's time series, basically. So what Bodan's working on is Q learning. So the idea is that there's a like, it's almost like a free energy, but it's a cost function that tries to maximize rewards. So you define a reward, I don't know what it is, plus one if this pendulum doesn't fall over, and minus one if it does, or something like that. And there's also time series. So S is time, I don't know. I guess it's state, you know. So N is labeling state zero, you know, state one, state two. And there's a discount factor, gamma. So the discount factor, if it's one, it means that any state at any other time will give you a reward or punishment just as strongly as the state right next to your current time. These things are typically like 80%, 90%. So there's some decay in rewards as a function of time. You can parameterize the Q function actually as basically a trace of e to the minus beta h. There's no beta. And that h can be a Bolson machine. And so what that looks like is a state and an action as the visible units of a Bolson machine, okay? And you basically just learn it, there's some weight and bias update that you can learn. So you can take exactly what you guys did and turn it into a reinforcement learning scheme and, I don't know, beat Go or something like that. So that's cool. This is what I talked about. This is another interesting connection between deep learning. I don't think Tishby will talk about this and the RG. So I don't have a lot of time to get into this, but people have noticed mappings between, if you take a layer of a Bolson machine, do a kind of coarse graining, do another coarse graining, you can basically map this exactly to the variational RG. So then you can start to ask whether or not the deep machines are somehow, the power of deep machines are somehow related to the power of the renormalization group. This is still a big open question. This has been a question for almost 4 years now. But here's some samples and reconstructions of criticalizing states in these deep RBMs. So that's an interesting connection to physics. People are also working on relating what Gifray does with tensor networks to Boltzmann machines. So this is a very active, when we go to Simons, we're all going to the Simons Flatiron Institute tomorrow. This will be a big topic of discussion, is how we relate tensor networks to neural network structures. I think that's pretty interesting. People have learned entanglement structures now using machine learning. So Yizheng Yu, who's at San Diego, basically took a type of machine learning. This is like a Mara structure. You know, this is one-dimensional UV physics rolled into a periodic boundary case. The entangling dimension, you know, it's like the ADS CFD of another dimension that's negatively curved. So this is your hyperbolic space. This is your minimal geodesic that would give you your entanglement entropy, right? This is a random tensor network. So he basically used machine learning to learn the structure of the Mara, if you will, learn the structure of critical tensor network by giving them a system input from a critical one-dimensional system. So this is pretty cool stuff. Miles, who's now at Flatiron, and Steve White are also using tensor network methods to do machine learning. Okay, so one idea is to map tensor networks to a deep machine and make it like a hybridized method. But you can also basically use straight up DMRG to do classification tasks and so on. So actually Miles wrote a really nice blog post on this Physics ML blog that explains how this works. So I recommend looking at that if you have time. I'm out of time. Oh, what was this? This was near term from a year ago, so let's see if it's, when were we in Brazil? Classical simulations for quantum models. That's what you guys are doing. That's what Jacmo showed you, is that you can basically make, you can take a Boltzmann machine, it's completely classical, you put it on a classical computer, and you encode the wave function, you either, you know, generate samples of the wave function, or you do classification tasks. The inverse problem is like cracking this thing open and trying to interpret it. So actually the support vector machine is a big step towards the inverse problem, but also just the idea of Hamiltonian verification or learning a Hamiltonian from a wave function. This is very interesting for people in like cold atoms, trapped ions. So if you go talk to Rajabul Islam on campus, he has a trapped ion setup that he wants to encode a Hamiltonian in with some sort of wave front engineering, like laser, like lenses that change the way the laser interacts with atoms. But once he does that, he's not sure exactly what Hamiltonian he built. So what he wants to do is measure the device and then do the inverse problem, learn the Hamiltonian from the measurements. Neural network decoders. So Puya Ronak, who's here, Ray LaFlamme's interested in this, the Caltech crew, David Poulin at Sherbrooke. So there's a lot of people now doing what I was talking about here and using neural networks for error correction. Tomography. So this is real experimental tomography where you encode a density matrix. I hope Giacomo showed you that this is possible. There's probably many other things. I think what Tishby's talking about today is really important. The idea that there's something non-trivial about deep structures. So we haven't explored this at all in physics yet. Now, deep learning kind of blew the field up in 2012 for image classification. And we all noticed, we started working on it. But the technology we're using isn't really tied to that revolution in deep learning. We use CNN, sure, they seem to work. But there's probably classical machine learning things that would have also worked. This is one area I think that's also I should put on this slide in terms of near-term applications. And hopefully, if we understand what Tishby's talking about, or if we understand how we take our physics data and we classify it and what neural network structures work and which ones don't and so on, hopefully we can transfer technology back to machine learning eventually, right? Tishby's a physicist by training. He's many things, but he's a physicist and he now is at the forefront of deep learning technology in computer science and so on. I think there's lots of room for physicists to contribute, okay? And we haven't really done this technology transfer yet back to machine learning. It's probably just a matter of time. Whoever speeds up their algorithms, even by a factor of 2 or a factor of 4, will instantly become rich, right? So there's some motivation to start thinking about that. CS students with PhDs from the big groups make $1 million salaries in Silicon Valley. So let me end with that. All right, thanks, guys.
The wrong PhD.